On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the great explosion of globalization that hit the world in the 1990s, former World Bank chief economist Lawrence Summers was boldly front and center, cheering on global markets as, ultimately, Bill Clinton's Secretary of the Treasury. From Washington, Summers went north to the presidency of Harvard University, where his high-octane, no-holds-barred style brought change, enemies, and a rough early exit. Now, Summers is looking back on what he's learned, most of all about the big pinch globalization is putting on the middle class. Up next on Point, political economist Larry Summers and what he's learned about the great big world. Joining me now in the studio is Lawrence Summers. He was chief economist at the World Bank from 1991 to 1993. He was U.S. Treasury Secretary from 1999 to 2001 after an important stretch as Deputy Secretary there. He was President of Harvard University from 2001 to 2006. He left after a turbulent tenure and a no-confidence vote by faculty, stung by his bulldog style and challenging views. He is currently University Professor at Harvard and a Managing Director at the Alternative Investment Fund D.E. Shaw. He writes a monthly column for the Financial Times, where he continues to take on big issues in the global economy. Larry Summers, welcome, and thanks very much for being with us.
Glad to be with you, Tom.
They say live and learn. When it comes to the global economy, first of all, you've lived. What have you learned? What have we all learned in the last decade since you were, and more, since you were at the World Bank and high in the Treasury Department?
I think we've learned two things. We've learned just how great the collective benefit from globalization can be. We've seen societies in the developing world transformed in a period of a decade. China is now growing at a rate where standards of living could increase 100-fold in a single human lifetime, with incredible consequences for people's ability to learn to read, to live lives that aren't confined to within 5 miles of a single village, of emancipation in the kinds of choices that women have that are something profoundly different than there's ever been. And at the same time, this globalization has contributed to a period when the U.S. economy has grown more rapidly, more stably, with less inflation and with lower interest rates than almost at any time in our past. And so this integration comes with tremendous benefits. But we've seen also that it poses challenges that policy will have to address, challenges that go to issues of insecurity and inequality. You know, when I went to graduate school, we were taught that the American income distribution was roughly constant, the share going to the top 10%, to the top 1%, to the middle 20%, and that if you wanted people to have higher standards of living, you had to grow the economy faster, and that was really all that it was about.
Ramp it up and off
what
we all go.
What we've seen now is that what happens to the middle class is very much about the underlying rate of growth, but it's also about patterns of inequality. If the income distribution in America were the same today as it was in 1979, there'd be about $670 billion a year more going to the lower 80% of the population. That's about $7,000 per person.
That's real money.
And that's real. And there'd be the same $674 billion lost to the top 1%, which would be nearly $600,000 per person in that top 1%. So we've seen big changes in inequality, and the challenge for public policy is going to be to strengthen progressive taxation, to strengthen modes for containing economic insecurity, providing insurance, and also looking to find and spur the innovations that will be major job creators in the years ahead. These are fantastic opportunities, more opportunities in many ways than the world has ever had before. but they come with very real challenges.
We'll look at those solutions, but I want to get a sense. You said it's a very different income distribution or more dynamic than you expected when you were in graduate school. But let's not go that far back. Just go back to the 90s when you were kind of in charge of significant elements of the economy and Clinton White House policy. You and Bob Rubin, very, very influential there in driving toward globalization. Did you guess in the 90s, did you suspect that we would see this effect, this dynamic of that loss of middle class standing or the bottom 80% standing that we have now witnessed in the last 10 or 15 years and more?
I think we underestimated the force of those trends, but in part we underestimated them because we didn't really conceive the kinds of policies that the country would pursue over the last 7 years.
I.e. the Bush
administration. We didn't contemplate that tax cuts would be heavily skewed towards those with the highest incomes. We didn't constitute that the focus of policy towards taxation would be to reduce the taxation even further of capital income relative to labor income. We assumed that there would be constructive efforts to strengthen the backbone of the system, Social Security, and assure that it would be there for the next generation. So we assumed that public policy would pursue a continuing path of being focused on the interests of the middle class, and we certainly recognized that there was a huge unfinished task with respect to health care. We recognized that there were large issues associated with assuring not more tax breaks for the most fortunate, but some basic ways of assuring that every family had a chance to build a nest egg as we worked with universal savings accounts. We were closely focused on questions relating to equality of opportunity and education. So, yes, and probably in some ways, the magnitude of the changes at the top end in the income distribution went beyond what we would have predicted. But the biggest surprises were in public policies, which went in very different ways than we would have predicted or certainly than we would have hoped.
So how do you divvy up responsibility for this inequality? How much do you put on public policy, in this case Bush administration policy in the last 7 years, and how much is just baked in the cake of globalization? How much comes along with the economic trends that globalization magnifies?
Well, I think on the economic non-policy side of the ledger, one shouldn't attribute all of this to globalization. A great deal of this has to do with technology, and it's very difficult to sort out what's technology and what's globalization, Tom, because it's heavily information technology, and it's the information technology that has, on the one hand, reinforced
right.
the most productive and, on the other hand, driven globalization. So there's a significant part that's due to underlying economic forces to which policy should be responding and offsetting rather than reinforcing. There's another significant component that is a consequence of policy, and both have to be addressed.
So you said for the middle class, in many ways, globalization ends up offering pretty thin gruel, your phrase in the Financial Times.
No, that was actually not my phrase in the Financial Times,
pretty
Tom.
Thin gruel.
Well, thin gruel was a reference to the policies that are sometimes suggested in response.
I think it's very
important to recognize that we wouldn't have mortgage rates in the fives and sixes without globalization. We wouldn't have the pie that's the size we have now to discuss the division of with inequality without globalization. We wouldn't have the inflation rates that had come to seem inconceivable in the 70s and 80s and early 90s without globalization. So I think it's a serious mistake to frame this, as many do, as a criticism or as an attack on globalization. If we try to wall off globalization, we're going to make all of us poorer. We're going to make the world a much more divided and unpleasant place. The question is how we respond. And I think I used the term thin gruel to refer to the suggestion that that the total response can be more education and the arguments that protectionism is harmful. We need to take steps towards more progressive taxation. We need to take steps towards assuring the investments in technology that are going to assure the next generation of leadership and job creation. We need to make sure that our institutions give everyone a chance to bargain for a fair wage.
Does it matter if there's inequality to an economist? You know, you'll have some who will say, come on, it doesn't matter. As long as the whole thing's growing, it's not so important how it's distributed, and even that the concentration of capital, concentration of wealth, can promote growth.
You know, the question of inequality is not something that you can derive a scientific result about, but to my values, to I think most Americans' values, to I think most economists' values, we certainly prefer a prosperity in which all can share. We certainly prefer a more equal income distribution to a less equal income distribution. That doesn't mean that you can elevate equality above all else. To do that would be to destroy incentives at enormous costs.
Let's take a call. Bill's calling from East Hampton, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air with Larry Summers.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Larry. I was wondering, you know, it seemed that President Clinton, when he signed the GATT and NAFTA, which seemed to bring us into this globalization period, he didn't seem to make any provisions for, like, retraining workers or leveling the playing field across the world. I mean, the labor costs are so much lower there, and there's no environmental laws in these other countries. I hear that people are in oppressive working conditions in places like Burma. Along with the World Trade Organization, shouldn't we have something like a world union organization, global unions, or a retraining of workers here? It seems like the World Trade Organization is going to be the new United Nations. But a lot of people are being left out of this new global economy.
Larry Summers, what do you say? Labor and environmental policy should be pushed abroad as globalization pushes in here?
It's a very thoughtful question, and I think this is an issue where the way it's thought about will continue to evolve. Actually, NAFTA was the first trade agreement that included any reference to the environment or included any reference to labor exploitation and labor standards. You can argue about the strength of the provisions.
You sure can.
But actually, the Clinton administration was the first to bring those issues into the whole trade dialogue. I think the other thing that is often assumed and is assumed in the caller's question that actually isn't right is that somehow globalization is about NAFTA and the GATT. It's not about that. It's about the fact that China is four times as productive a society as it was 20 years ago. It's about the fact that vastly more can be traded with the internet. It's about the fact that the United States has basically been an open market for a long time. If you look at NAFTA, the trade barriers that were reduced in Mexico were five or seven times as large as any trade barriers that the United States reduced. If you look at the WTO, it's the same thing. These trade agreements are all highly asymmetric because our market is so open. To resist these trade agreements is simply to shoot ourselves in the foot. We're not changing access to the American market very much. And if we resist these trade agreements, we're losing a ton of access to foreign markets.
What
and we're losing
ask,
any opportunity to have any influence in these societies.
What about to ask more of these agreements? You know, Bill saying, what about requiring certain labor standards or environmental standards stronger than the references in NAFTA when we acknowledge and codify this open market?
I think it's a complicated question. Would we think it was legitimate for European countries to say that our health insurance policies or lack of health insurance policies should be part of a trade agreement? Or would we say that we're a democratic country, that's our policy to set, and that's not something that should be subject to international negotiation?
China,
it's
Burma,
really
not
the same,
democratic
it's really
countries.
The same parallel, it's really the same parallel argument. Should there be protections against exploitation of labor? Yes. Are there protections against exploitation of labor? Yes. Is any appreciable amount of American job loss related to exploitative practices such as the abuses that take place in Burma, that's not a case that's ever been made. Do poorer countries have lower wages than the United States? Absolutely they do. Would it be reasonable to impoverish those countries further by seeking to insist that in those much less productive countries with much less capital, they paid their workers in a way comparable to the way we pay our workers in the United States? No, I don't think that would be reasonable at all.
If there's balancing to be done, then it must all be done here. I mean, I've read just in the last few days, let's say American furniture makers are having a lot of furniture made in China now. And the president of a big company saying, you know, you wouldn't want to work in some of these places. We're working on it. We're trying to make it better. But you, American worker, would not want to work in the conditions that he's seen in some of these factories. Does it all have to be compensated for at this end? Can there be no push out into China?
Compensated at this end, I think you're thinking about it wrong. First of all, in China, the people who get those jobs regard it as a great opportunity because it's a much poorer country. People line up for those jobs. Any job that involves exporting to the United States is a job that people are seeking as vastly better than the alternatives in those countries. So let's be clear, if this was really exploitation in these countries, there wouldn't be 10 people lining up for every one job.
Well, it depends on the level of need.
That
I mean,
was on
we
offer.
People lining
it's a,
up for
it's
coal
a poor,
mining jobs
it's a
in this
poor
country
to kill
people.
It's a poor country.
Yeah.
There's a challenge of the fact that it is a poor country. The way countries get richer is they move up the ladder. Jobs get better and better. As for competition here, we could try to hold on to the lowest end, least skilled jobs that are most easily done in the least productive and poorest countries in the world. That would be one strategy. But I would tell you that it's a much better forward-looking strategy to try to prepare our people for the industries of the future, to try to make sure that we are creating jobs, that we are creating the areas of economic strength that will provide strong middle-class jobs in the future, rather than trying to hold on to the jobs of the past.
So when you talk about more progressive taxation, and of course that's been reduced under President Bush, that would mean, presumably, you're saying more revenue. And what would be done with that then? To train American workers or just to lower the deficit and create economic circumstances for faster growth? I'm looking for where's the intervention to help the worker who you're describing as being, you know, ultimately disadvantaged by what we've seen going on in the last decade?
First of all, the lower interest rates that would come with a more reasonable fiscal policy.
Smaller
deficits.
Would
mean more investment. Would mean more tools for those workers, would mean more productivity, would mean higher wages. Second, the kinds of provisions that we pushed for in the Clinton administration to improve the universality of health care so that people didn't have to rely on themselves to get their health care, so that employers weren't burdened by health care, would support employment and job creation in the United States. Third, there clearly does need to be more investment, not just in workers, by the way, who lose their jobs because of international trade, but in workers who lose their jobs because of technology and workers who lose their jobs because of all the vicissitudes of economic life. You know, if you look at the data in the United States, 4 million job separations take place each month. And so there's a tremendous amount we need to do to increase the level of economic security. But trying, in what will be a largely futile attempt, to wall off the rest of the world would be a short-sighted way to go at it.
I guess I'm trying to figure out if your action plan has evolved or changed, your sense of what needs to be done has changed in the last dozen years, or if it's essentially the same formula. What you described just now is essentially the same formula you were articulating as Deputy Treasury Secretary, at least to my ears. Is there some further twist on what you're saying may be necessary to address this inequality that you're now proposing?
I think the importance of more progressive taxation is much greater as inequality has increased. I think the magnitude of the challenge in terms of retraining and education is larger than we saw it as being in the 1990s. And I think we do need to think more systematically about the technologies that are going to spur the economy forward. You know, the information technology revolution that had a great deal to do with our prosperity during the 1990s had a great deal to do with what the government had funded in terms of research earlier in the creation of the Internet. We've now cut the NIH budget, which is funding what may well be the next key area of technology in the life sciences. We've cut that budget by, for the first time in 40 years. That's crazy. So I don't think the broad parameters of what's necessary to succeed have changed, but certainly the degree of emphasis that needs to be placed on different parts of the recipe has changed. And the key thing is not going to be some detail of some agreement we reach with other countries. It's going to be what we do here to take responsibility for our prosperity, and there's much more we can do.
We're talking with former U.S. Treasury Secretary and President of Harvard University, Larry Summers. Rick is calling from Wellesley, Massachusetts. Rick, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thank you. Larry Summers talked a little bit about what I think is important, and that's education, but it seems to me it's not getting enough emphasis. You're putting a lot of emphasis on things like increasing taxes, strengthening wages, which would make us less competitive in the global economy, versus if we invest more in education and bring that 80% up, we could actually steal share from the global economy and increase us all and benefit even more from the global economy. Why isn't there more emphasis on that?
Lawrence Summers.
I couldn't agree with you more about the importance of education. The only difference is that education is a strategy that pays off over very long periods of time, and we clearly have very serious concerns today. Even if we achieved a spectacular improvement in the quality of public education, 80% of the workforce in 2020 is already in the workforce, or at least has completed their public education. So that's absolutely essential and is probably the most important thing for the long run, but it is a longer-term concern. On the subject of education, we clearly need elements of both the liberal solution and the conservatives' solution.
Meaning?
The conservatives are right that without more accountability, more measurement, more competition, more incentives, simply putting funds into the system isn't going to produce meaningful results. But I used to, every time I visited a city as Secretary of the Treasury, I would go visit an inner-city school. I saw schools, school after school, where we told our kids that education was the most important thing, but we showed them otherwise by asking them to go to school in classrooms where the paint was falling off the walls. We told them there was nothing more important than to integrate their education with their overall well-being, but we educated them in schools that were so crowded that lunch hour began at 9:45 in the morning because that was the only way to get all the kids through the cafeteria. We told them that it was terribly, terribly important that they do their homework and that they learn and that they develop responsibility. But we had schools being used two shifts a day with class beginning for some students at 3 in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. These aren't the ways we make real a commitment to education being excellent. Do we treat teaching as a valued and honored profession? I often think not in aspects of the way we compensate teachers, where we don't reward the teachers who are most able. Do we restrict too much? You know, I've been in my share of controversies. I've done some things right and some things wrong in life, but I imagine I am qualified to teach economics in a public school in the state of Massachusetts. But according to the rules that prevail, it is otherwise I am not certified. Surely those kinds of barriers should be reduced. So I didn't talk about education because you can't talk about everything initially, and I was focusing on some issues that I thought would really be where the rubber was meeting the road in the next few years. But you are absolutely right on the essential aspect that is education.
There's an urgency around all of this that you're articulating and many others see as well. I want to ask you, Larry Summers, you've sat in some pretty big chairs, chief economist at the World Bank, treasury secretary, president of Harvard. When it comes to influencing the direction of the country and policy, and you look back on those, which is most important? Which is most consequential?
Oh, I've been honored to be in all of those places, and I think it's very...
Well, you're a restless guy. You're not patient. You want things to happen. So
I think it's very hard to compare. There's an immediacy about what the government does in responding to an event like the Mexican financial crisis.
You were right in the middle of it.
That's unlike anything else that other institutions do. On the other hand, over time, I think the kinds of ideas that come out of universities, that come out of the kind of research done at places like the World Bank, makes a huge difference. You know, one of the things we did when I was at the World Bank was we initiated a report that looked in a very quantitative way at global health issues. Well, down the road, we thought of it as a useful piece of research. That turned out to be the report that Bill Gates read and got interested in the whole subject of global health, which led to his philanthropy in that area. So research, new ideas, these things also have a tremendous impact on the world over time. I don't think it's a comparison that you can really make.
Long causal chains you've spoken about recently, that things don't necessarily unfold on the cycles that we expect. You plant a seed and it takes a long time to show up. Are you finding, you know, what you planted coming back positively, negatively? I mean, you know, we grow past some thoughts, and yet they're still part of a causal chain.
I look at the kind of emphasis we placed on global health, the kind of emphasis I focused on girls' education when I was at the World Bank, and how those issues have taken off, and I take a great deal of satisfaction. I look at the efforts we made in the Clinton administration to contain financial crises and see the tremendous health of the Asian economies today, the efforts we made at debt relief and see how those have translated into increased investments in fighting AIDS. I fought for some things I thought were very important at Harvard. Equal access, elimination of tuition for students from families with incomes below $60,000, a rededication of the university whose commitment to the sciences had languished in some very important respects, the idea that students who wanted to understand the world should actually visit the world as part of their education. I think over time, those things are going to make a very large difference. So we'll see how it all plays out.
Let's talk about Harvard University and the opportunity cost of leaving that position earlier than you probably expected. You ran into a lot of pushback from the faculty there on a lot of fronts. I mean, you're a guy who comes on like gangbusters. Not everybody liked that. In particular, comments about affinity for the sciences and women set off a kind of a firestorm. You have called those remarks since you left Harvard an act of spectacular imprudence. How do you look at the sort of ball of things that took you out of that particular environment, that particular role? How do you look back on it now?
History will be the judge, and I'll certainly never be an objective observer. But in the fullness of it, I'm proud of what was accomplished at Harvard during my time. I'm proud that Harvard became a leader in assuring fairness in access to higher education at a time when only 3% of the students in American higher education come from the lower quarter of the income distribution. And those who are average or below are 80% underrepresented, far worse than any minority group. I'm proud that over 5 years, Harvard went from being a school which had one of the lowest fractions of students who had an international experience while they were at Harvard to be well on its way to the point where every Harvard student, as part of their education, will have an international experience while they're in the university or over the summer.
So you're proud of what happened, but what about the opportunity cost? You know that as an economist of leaving.
I'm proud of the fact that issues that, frankly, should have been on the table and were not, the fact that if you look at ratings of senior surveys, Harvard students were more dissatisfied with their education than the students in almost any other major school. Those are now issues that the community is very much grappling with. I'm proud that the university is thinking in a much more ambitious way about sciences, not in the traditional stovepipes of physics and biology, but cutting across boundaries. I heard yesterday about a mathematician who was working with a public health specialist using computational techniques to address malaria, a disease that kills several million people a year. Those kinds of things weren't happening at Harvard 6 years ago. And I'm obviously not the reason those things are happening, but I think there was a great deal of energy that was unleashed. And with that energy came friction. Not friction with the students, who I think very much wanted to see a kind of opening up and a greater responsiveness to them. Not friction with the faculty of the professional schools, whose orientation very much is to making a difference in the world and advancing their profession rather than maintaining tradition. But the rifts, and, you know, I'm sure there are things I could have handled better with Harvard's most traditional and most inward-looking faculty, the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, got so tense that it really wasn't viable to continue. And I obviously wish that it would have been otherwise. But I did this job the way I know how to do things, trying to look to the future, trying to push to the future. And I think that when people look back, they'll see that an enormous amount of progress towards a new agenda for the university was made in my 5 years. And ultimately, that's much more important than how long I served or what controversies there were or any issues of personality.
But there's an important question here about the flexibility and openness of the American academic system, and at the same time, how it's led. I mean, so at that point, it does sort of matter whether there was too much bully in your bully pulpit or whether there's something about university life in America that's not open to stern challenges. You said you were spectacularly imprudent in bringing up your question about gender and the sciences because it was not a good question or because you misjudged the environment where you were bringing it up?
Look, I thought I was in what I was invited to participate in, which was a small scientific seminar to look at research issues, not a place for policy pronouncements. Someone walked out of that room and called the Boston Globe. That's not my idea of scholarly behavior, but that doesn't matter. It was my job as president to gauge my environment and to gauge what the impact of my actions would be. And yes, I think the remarks as they were reported were terribly distorted and exaggerated. But that doesn't mean that it wasn't my responsibility to avoid setting off that kind of firestorm. So much as I regret that it sometimes seems that universities are places where some subjects are beyond discussion and beyond debate, much as I regret the pressures that are placed on most university presidents to become generators of platitudes, it was my job to recognize that this could blow up in the way it did and to avoid that blow up. And that's why I take responsibility. And I did take responsibility for making that serious mistake. At the same time, I think there's much that can be learned about universities, the way in which they're governed, the traditional emphasis of many faculty on prerogative, a belief in diversity in many dimensions, but on some important questions, very little desire for a diversity of views and debate. These are all issues that it seems to me the academic community needs to think about.
You were and remain a big champion of the life sciences. and anticipating huge breakthroughs in the life sciences in this century. Do you think those breakthroughs are going to further challenge some of our presumptions about each other and about what we're equipped for, about strengths and weaknesses? I mean, that was at the heart of your question, as I understood it anyway, about gender and science. Are we going to be challenged by the life sciences to sort of review some of our social, political presumptions forged in the last half century, century?
I'm not myself a life scientist, so I don't want to make scientific judgments, but it would be hard for me to believe that there would be revolutions in biology that wouldn't change some of our conceptions in ways that I think are very difficult for us to predict. We've seen some of this already, as people have been astounded by the results of identical twin studies that look at separated identical twins and discover, even though they've been separated from birth, how remarkably similar they are on many, many dimensions, what their hobbies are, what the appearance of the women they marry is, what their interests are, what their degree of religiosity is. I think that came as an enormous surprise to many people, and I certainly don't think it's the last surprise that will come out of biological research.
You've said that if we hope to hold on to our economic position in this century, we're going to have to be as successful in life sciences as maybe we were in manufacturing and industrial applications in the 20th century, but that you're concerned quite beyond taxation and economic policy that a certain disrespect for fundamental pursuit of science has crept into our national politics. Do you see that as an important
factor? I think
it
manifests itself, Tom, in a number of ways. It manifests itself in the fact that even as the life sciences is at this moment of maximum achievement, there's more creationism, or as it's now labeled, intelligent design in the public schools than at any time since the Scopes trial. It's there in the fact that in intellectual communities like Harvard, people would never admit to not knowing five plays by Shakespeare, but many people think it's fashionable to admit that they don't know the difference between a gene and a chromosome. I am offended every time I see someone introduce a scientist they're about to honor by quoting a few bits of language that the scientist used and then saying, ha-ha, none of us can expect to understand this. You know, there was a video done at a Harvard commencement some years ago in which the graduating seniors and perhaps even some members of the faculty were asked why it was colder in the winter than in the summer, the right answer being that the Earth is tilted on its axis. Almost none of them knew that. I think that's a deeply troubling commentary on the kind of education we're providing.
That itself seems hard to believe.
No, I can show you the video. No question about it. But I think our universities are going to have to adapt much more than they have if we're going to have the kind of scientifically literate society that we need in the 21st century.
Larry Summers, let us turn to more listeners. Let's go to Beaufort, North Carolina, and Mike. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Mrs. Summers. Come back to the globalization discussion we had before.
Mm-hmm.
How would you address the point that most of the people, or that many people who claim to look forward to the benefits that are here are coming, are people who are in pretty secure jobs or corporate managers who profit from this, whilst the cost of a transition, which is only kind of often specified in abstract terms, but the cost of transition fall on a generation or two of Americans in the industrial manufacturing heartlands who just have nowhere to turn, whose training maybe is not producing anything, and there's not enough. The weight is not borne equally within our society between the two segments, those who look for, who benefit now and who speak abstractly, and those who suffer the costs of them.
A strong question, Mike. Larry Summers.
Let me ask the caller something. Have you shopped at Walmart for clothing or for toys or at Target or at any other large store in the last month?
Yes.
Well, then in some very important ways, you were a major beneficiary of globalization.
Of course.
Because, and I don't know your situation, but when we bring down the price of necessities, of food, of clothing, of toys for children,
but is that it? Mike asked that big question.
The interest rates that are part of the cost, much of the cost of housing, we are benefiting not just the privileged, but we are benefiting everyone.
Does it offset the $7,000 hit you described earlier? Mike raises a big question. You throw him Walmart?
No, I understand. But one very important part of the answer on globalization is that people don't see a very important part of the benefits. People don't see all the benefits in terms of lower prices, what economists call more purchasing power. They don't see the benefits of having a 4.5% unemployment rate rather than the 6.5% unemployment rates that we used to take
Mike
for granted.
Mike sounds like a smart guy.
There needs to be more redistribution. That's why I began talking about progressive taxation. Sure, there needs to be more retraining. Sure, we need to make sure that the playing field is fair in competition. But let's not forget what all the benefits are. And if we were to try to wall all this off, the consequences would be catastrophic.
Mike, what do you say?
I just wonder whether people who have very little income are really so, or much, maybe some of the food shopping is on food stamps, whether the nickel or dime or whatever that's saved by having those purchases they can make come from another country compensate for the lack of total income.
Well, I'm not going to say that in every single case immediately it does compensate. Clearly it doesn't, and clearly we need to strengthen our unemployment insurance. Clearly there are a whole set of things we need to do to reduce income security. But I can tell you that people don't think about those benefits at all. And if everything you buy is 10% cheaper, that's a lot like having a 10% higher salary. And that side of the globalization debate is something that I don't think gets enough attention.
Your views have been very influential in Democratic Party policy circles for a long time. You're listening to the contenders for the Democratic nomination on the stump right now. Are they singing your song? When they talk about not extending, let's say, the Bush tax cuts, is that equivalent to the more progressive tax you're calling for, or do you want more than that? And what about the rest? Do you hear your view manifest in the Democratic presidential contenders' debate and conversation about what they would do?
Oh, I think there's a great deal that makes very good sense to me that's being said by each of the Democratic major Democratic candidates. I myself like to see more emphasis on collecting the taxes that are owed but not paid. It staggers the imagination that a country in which Visa can track everybody down at 30 million outlets around the world and collect within a month can't collect more than 85% of the taxes that are owed. I'd like to see more attention to some comprehensive reform of business taxation, where we've managed to create a system where we have the second highest corporate tax rate but one of the lowest corporate revenues levels in the OECD. I'd like to see healthcare plans laid out in as much detail as possible, because I think that's now a sixth of our economy. So it's crucial for our competitiveness. And it's obviously, as one who's been seriously ill in the past, the most important thing that can happen to an individual that affects their happiness. I think we all need to think a great deal about this question of what we do as a country that maximizes the likelihood that we'll be the place where the next internets happen. Industrial policy is a bad idea, but on the other hand, I don't think we can forget entirely this question of the structure of our economy.
We've got 10 seconds. Are you, Larry Summers, looking at getting back into public life at the governmental level?
I'm loving the opportunity to speak out that I have right now, free from the responsibility of representing any institution.
And we hear it. Lawrence Summers, former U.S. Treasury Secretary and Harvard President, thank you very much for being with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.